The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Edinburgh Hospital Authority doing business is Edinburgh General Hospital versus Shirley and Oscar Trevino from Hidalgo County. Mary Ann Smothers Bruni versus Robert Joseph Bruni from Bexar County. And Griffin Industries Incorporated and others versus the Honorable 13th Court of Appeals on original mandamus proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument in each of these causes. The relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will complete these arguments before the noon break. If you wish to purchase a tape of the argument, you may make application with the clerk of our court. We are ready to hear argument from petitioner in Edinburgh versus Trevino.
May it please the court, Mr. Dean Davis will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I'm pleased to represent the Edinburgh Hospital Authority this morning in a petition to you from an adverse decision from the 13th Court. This is a medical malpractice case against a doctor in a hospital. The doctor settled. The case went to trial against the hospital. Tort Claims Hospital. The jury awarded $250,000 to the plaintiff's wife, $250,000 to the bystander plaintiff's husband. This matter was appealed to the 13th Court. The court took this case and affirmed the trial court decision. We filed an application for writ of error, 11 points of error. You have granted our application for writ on 6 of those points. I have represented hospitals for 37 years, and I have not had occasion to read the court civil appeals opinion that was more damaging to the Texas Tort Claims Act in general, and to the hospitals of the state in particular, than this case. It is our judgment that in this case, Court of Appeals has created a new cause of action for mental anguish because of a stillbirth, contrary to your decision in Patila versus Price. The 13th Court has permitted recovery for only mental anguish damages for the stillbirth of a fetus without any injury to the mother, contrary to this court's decision in Cressman versus Supervada, and this court's decision interpreting Supervada in Cathy versus Booth. The 13th Court has permitted Shirley and Oscar Trevino to be awarded damages for mental anguish against a tort claims hospital whose only liability exposure is for bodily injury, death, and property damage, and has permitted each of these individuals to recover statutory maximums when the Tort Claims Act applies a single maximum to an injured person only against the advice of this court in the City of Austin versus Cooksey. The Court of Appeals has permitted a bystander claim to be pursued without requiring each prong of a three-point test to be met by the proposed bystander, contrary to your decision in Freeman versus City of Pasadena. The The 13th Court has ignored specific legislative directives that a municipal hospital authority, under the appropriate sections of the Health and Safety Code, are specifically directed to be units of local government and not municipalities. And yet the Court of Appeals has held that the Edinburgh Hospital Authority is a municipality. In doing so, it has ignored the limit for a local unit of government, $100,000, and has imposed a $250,000 limit that is the limit for a city. And this is not a city. It is a municipal hospital district. The third court has ignored at least four courts of appeals decisions that have held there is no cause of action for a bystander in recovery in a malpractice case involving treatment or a misdiagnosis. The Robinson case denied out of Fort Worth. The Cavanaugh case denied out of Austin. The Estrada case denied out of Houston. The Rosenzweig case denied out of Dallas. The Court of Appeals has ignored ignored and found that the limitations for a municipal hospital authority is $100,000, is not $100,000, but $250,000, and has ignored the only analysis done by any Court of Appeals, the Huckabee Court, with no mention of any distinguishing characteristics whatsoever in this case. Simply that Huckabee was conquered. And finally, that this court has gone against two different courts with respect to the way it applies settlement credits in the determination of what is to be reduced from a judgment. And in fact, did a reduction from a jury verdict, not a judgment. And the judgment in this court entered by Judge Barnes, the trial judge, shows exactly the mistake that he made.
Counsel, two questions concerning physical injury.
Yes, sir.
One is, were there any pleadings claiming physical injury as apart from mental anguish? And two, was there a jury issue submitted to the jury on physical injury apart from mental anguish?
Your Honor, during the course of this trial, it is my belief that at the time the case went to trial, there were not active pleadings asking for a judgment or damages for physical injury for either Shirley Trevino or Oscar Trevino.
And I'm really referring right now only to Shirley.
Yes, with respect to Shirley. With respect to the issues found by the court, there was only one issue submitted with respect to Shirley. And that issue reads as follows. What sum of money, if paid now in cash, would fairly and reasonably compensate Shirley Morrow, and that's Shirley Trevino, for the mental anguish, if any, that resulted from the loss of the fetus on the occasion in question? The only question, Your Honor, that was submitted with respect to damage.
Mr. Davis, why is it your belief that there was no claim for physical injury to Ms. Trevino?
To Mrs. Trevino?
All right. You said it's your belief, but...
There was no.
Okay. So the pleadings didn't have that?
No, sir. The jury did not have that. The jury was not asked, was there injury to Shirley Trevino? The jury was only asked, did Shirley Trevino have mental anguish as a result of the loss of feet? This takes us to a discussion of this court's incredibly important decision to hospitals and to the citizens of this state in Sepulveda. In Sepulveda, this court decided that it was not contra to Price, wherein you held there was no cause of action for the death or injury of the fetus. But in some provision you held that if, in fact, there was injury, and in Kathy you held, per curiam, if there was, in fact, an injury to the mother, occasioned by negligence, that and there was a stillbirth, that the mother was entitled to collect damages for mental anguish, including the loss of the child or the fetus. Vitally important case, and it's important in this case because what I believe happened, these cases were from a similar area of the state, and Supervita went up through the judicial system with Trevino right behind it. And the jury wasn't asked about injury to the mother at the trial level. But my colleagues argued vociferously for injury at the Court of Appeals level, with Sepulveda up ahead and the Court of Civil Appeals already having decided the same court that there was bodily injury to Mrs. Sepulveda.
Even though it was not pled in that case either?
Well, Your Honor, it was not pled in that case.
The court made it up.
I think there was...
The Court of Appeals made it up and this court affirmed it.
I think there was more reference to injury to the mother, at least in the court's opinion, it referenced injury to the mother. And I read Your Honor's eloquent and important dissent in the case. But I do not think...
You agree with me that we ought to recognize the duty to the mother, the child, and the father?
I do not, sir.
All right. You can proceed with your argument.
Yes, sir. I believe that is an issue that most appropriately is before and up for, and that's the legislature.
Do you agree here that there was injury to the mother, physical injury to the mother, just that it wasn't pled and there was no issue submitted on it?
Your Honor, the mother testified there was no injury. The mother testified that her only grievance was a mental anguish grievance for the loss of the fetus. She didn't say there was injury. I don't think there was injury.
Well, you can see that there was injury to the placenta and the placental wall and hemorrhaging as a result of that.
There's no question there was a placental abruption in this case, and this is what Oscar Trevino saw.
And you would not classify that as a physical injury?
I would not classify it as a physical injury that these plaintiffs wanted any damages for.
Okay, I can see that, but there was, you can see there was a physical injury, just no pleadings or jury questions submitted concerning that.
I concede, Your Honor, that there was a placenta abruption. There was testimony from witnesses, from expert witnesses on both sides as to what caused that, whether it was caused by the hospital. The jury chose to go with the experts for the plaintiff. I do not believe that it is, that if in fact it was an injury, that it was either pled or proved or asked about or found on the jury. Right. And that suggests to me that nobody thought it was an injury. Certainly Shirley Trevino did not.
Okay, I want to ask you a question in a different area before
yes,
we run out of time, and that
sure.
is, it concerns the credit issue.
Yes, sir.
If we were to apply the credit the way you want it applied, would that not mean that in an extreme majority of cases where there are defendants who are found liable other than a governmental unit, it would basically eviscerate liability for the governmental unit?
And it would, Your Honor. That is not a function, though, I suggest to you, of the Texas Tort Claims Act. It is not a function of the statutes that provide for the way in which certain credits are awarded. It is certainly nothing within the purview or control of the defendant hospital. It's in the total control of the plaintiff as to whether or not they want to settle. But there is no question that if they do settle and they go against the Tort Claims Hospital, and the amount is large for the settling defendant, then the chances of the tort claims hospital having a judgment are not very good. And that's exactly the way the legislature voted. That's the way two of your courts of appeals have interpreted it. And, Your Honor, all three courts, including the one cited by my colleagues, have done a reduction of settlement credits from a judgment. In this case, it wasn't done from a judgment. The judgment in this case was for $250,000. The settlement credit was taken from the verdict. No case says that's the way you do it. Two cases say that the way you do it, and it's illustrated, is that you go to the maximum liability limit that the governmental entity has. If it's a city, 250. If it's a county, of 100,000. And then you make your deductions from that particular maximum liability finding. I have just a few more seconds, and if I might quickly pass to the bystander issue, a tremendously important one. This is a tort claims hospital. The bystander issue.
Your time has expired, counsel. You can address it.
And we'll do that on the record. Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Preston Henderson and Mr. Richard Schell will present arguments for the respondent. Mr. Henderson will present the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court, thank you for hearing us this morning. I appreciate personally the courtesy of the court in rescheduling the argument for my comments. It was very, very good of the court. I'm here to respond to the arguments of counsel for the hospital. My good friend Dean Davis and I didn't apparently read the same opinion below. I want you to know that I represent Oscar Trevino, the husband at the time below in the court below. Mr. Trevino is here on the front row, as is Shirley Trevino, who is represented today in the court below by Mr. Rick Schell and Mr. John David Franz. In our argument today, I'm going to discuss issues 1, 7, and 8, the threshold issues of duty and the evidence. And I'd like to respond, first of all, to the issue of pleading. I disagree vehemently. At page 8 of my brief, in response to the application for writ of error in this case, I set out portions of the live pleadings of Shirley Trevino in which he pled that the hospital acting through its agents employees with negligent care and treatment of Shirley resulted in the death of a full-term baby, constituted negligent infliction of mental anguish to her, and then in paragraph 4, says the untimely administration of anesthesia, use of equipment, all of which was owned by the hospital, was approximate cause of damages to plaintiff. The generality of that allegation is not accepted to. This issue was tried by consent. The damages to plaintiff were the injuries to plaintiff. It would be useful to say that this case was tried in January of 93. Your case, Boyles versus Kerr, came out the first version of that opinion came out in December, I believe, and we looked at it very carefully. We also had seen the Sepulveda versus Krishnan Court of Appeals opinion, which affirmed the right of the mom to recover for the injuries to her, the mental anguish for the injuries to her, and we tried the case specifically on those points. The presentation, the argument, which is in the record, the opening argument, the evidence, and the final argument, all was focused on the issue of injuries to the mom and the mental anguish that resulted from that. And that issue says what, issue number 2 says what damages, or what amount of money should be paid for damages to Shirley Trevino for the loss of the fetus, which we say is a portion of her body at that time, which is an injury to her at that time. We also agree that there was an injury to her when the placenta abrupted. And
it seems like that injury exists, but looking at these paragraphs, I still don't see any pleadings claiming physical injury as opposed to mental anguish.
I agree, Your Honor. In Shirley Trevino's pleadings, there's no direct allegation of physical injury to her. The understanding and the intention of the plaintiff, Shirley Trevino's counsel, was to allege, and the case was tried, I think, by consent, that the injury to the fetus was an injury to her. And that statement occurs throughout the record during the trial. I think if you look at my pleadings on behalf of Oscar Trevino, in the transcript, you will see that I specifically pled an injury to the Shirley Trevino, which my client was a bystander, and of which my client was owed a duty, separate duty. And I believe that the...
What court has recognized a duty to the father in these circumstances?
I beg your pardon?
What court in Texas has recognized a duty to the father of the baby in these type of circumstances?
I believe that there, Judge, that there are a number of cases in which, if I understand the Boyles decision, and I read it very carefully before we tried this case, that if there is an independent source of duty to anyone, that then you can proceed for a breach of that duty and damages for mental anguish. And in this case, we have specific duties which are assumed by the hospital. In the nursing standards set out in pages 148 through 150 in the record of trial, which say patients and or significant others can expect nursing units to have emergency equipment, can expect nurses to develop plans for nursing care, can expect nurses to provide appropriate quality care with respect for patient individuality. And by assuming...
The short answer is there's no case.
Judge, under these circumstances, in a medical negligence circumstance, no. But I think there are many cases which show that a direct duty applies to the husband. And there's certainly some California cases that in this area that do establish that a direct duty is also another manner in which the husband can recover. And in this case, we have a bystander, which is a classic bystander, which meets all the tests of the Dillon Freeman test.
Again, there is no, can you cite to me a case that has allowed bystander recovery under these type of circumstances?
In a hospital environment, yes, medical negligence? No, Your Honor, I cannot, although there's absolutely nothing in the bystander doctrine which would justify carving out an exception under these circumstances. And in fact, every time in every case that's cited by the appellant where it says that it disallows a recovery for a bystander, it says, but that's under these facts. And it does not prohibit or say, any of those cases say that a bystander cannot recover. It just says under those facts a bystander cannot recover. And we would say that we distinguish those cases. There's no case that says a bystander cannot recover in Texas.
This would be a case of first impression.
In that respect, yes. And I would suggest it's really a very narrow case, because in this situation, we have a situation where the nurses fail to monitor the fetal heart monitor properly, the hospital equipment. Doctor testified that the nurses set the Pitocin levels too high to induce labor. They also failed to discontinue the Pitocin levels early enough, and all those things caused the placental abruption, which occurred in the presence of my client. He was in the delivery room or labor room during the time that occurred. He was aware there was a controversy going on between the doctor and the hospital about the Pitocin levels. He was concerned about that, and he then saw this bleeding event and was present when it happened, and we set out the test, some of the testimony about his impressions, the shock that occurred. He was in the room when this accident occurred, and he witnessed and saw and felt the injury to his wife, meeting all of those tests, and all three of those tests very clearly. It was then that the next thing occurred. The hospital failed to use the paging system. They failed to use the communications equipment properly to get to assemble the surgical team. And he waited with the doctor and the nurses watching this emergency situation and experienced the concern over this undue delay. It took an hour and 13 minutes from the time of the call for the team until the anesthesia took place. And that was, and the standard of care is 30 minutes. The doctor got so upset that he actually wheeled her down to the operating room in the gurney by himself. My client was present at all events except for the actual delivery of the fetus, and he received the dead fetus from the doctor. He experienced the whole thing. The only thing he did not physically see or hear himself was the actual delivery of the fetus. That's simply the outcome. None of the bystander cases require him to be present when the outcome occurs, only present when the injury occurs, when the initial injury is the bleeding.
But where the court has allowed bystander recovery, ordinarily there's been a sudden brief event causing injury, like a car accident. And what's the sudden brief event causing injury here?
The placenta abruption, which occurred and immediately resulted in the bleeding. That all occurred as a result of the use of this hospital Pitocin equipment and the Pitocin drug and the failure to monitor the heart trench carefully and to monitor the mother carefully. And as a result, boom, this amniotic sac tore away from the uterus and caused this hemorrhaging, which is an injury to her body.
Would you explain what this equipment is again and how that qualifies as a tangible personal property under the Tort Claims Act?
Of course, Chief Justice. The Pitocin is a labor-inducing drug, which is set up on an intravenous drip. The doctor told the nurse to start it according to protocol. By her own admission, she started it at a higher level than it was supposed to be started. And the Dr. Barnes, our expert, testified that it was started at too high a level, and it was not discontinued when it should have been discontinued.
My Any time. Other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
May I please the court? It's an honor to be present before the esteemed court, and I'll move directly to point of error number 9, which is the issue regarding whether or not the Edinburgh Hospital Authority is a local governmental unit or a part or extension of a municipality. To begin with,
what board of directors governs the policies of that hospital?
There is a board of directors that is appointed by the City of Edinburgh.
So it's part of the municipality?
That's true.
That is an agency of the municipality?
Exactly. And the
or city, the municipality in and of itself?
The City of Edinburgh has the authority to appoint the board, to replace the board, to replace particular members of the board, etc. What I think is particularly interesting here, and which I find to be a bit disappointing, is the argument that has been presented by the petitioner and by the amicus curiae regarding the application of section 262.035D, which is the section of the Health and Safety Code which says that a municipal hospital authority is considered to be a local unit of government, not a municipality, for purposes of the Tort Claims Act. And that's cited heavily in the petitioner's writ application. It's cited heavily in the amicus.
How's that wrong?
Well, if you look at it, it looks very persuasive, in fact, controlling. But if you read the fine print at the end of that statute, what you'll discover is that that particular section did not exist, had not been passed, was not effective when the cause of action accrued, when the case was tried, and when the judgment was rendered. That particular section, that statute, which these folks are relying upon, did not become effective until June 11 of 1993, 4 years, over 4 years after the cause of action accrued, 5 months after the trial, 5 months after a judgment was rendered. And it's fundamental in Texas that a statute operates prospectively. The government code provides that it's presumed that there's prospective application unless the statute specifically says that it's retrospective. But here in this court, the petitioner and the amicus have come in and pretended that section 262.035 has always existed, and were completely silent about the enactment date of that statute.
Was that statute just to clarify the earlier law, or do you view it as being changed?
It's a complete change in the law. And let's say that the statute did exist at that point in time. Even if it did, it doesn't avail the defense here anything, because that particular statute, if the court will read the operative language, says that a municipal hospital authority subject to this section is a local unit of government and not a municipality. Subject to the section is the key phrase within that subsection D of that statute. So what is subject to this section? Section 262.035 relates to the lease of hospital facilities by hospital authorities. And that's all that section relates to, the lease of hospital facilities. Not only that, but in subsection A of that section, it's very clear that the section applies, and I quote the statute, applies only to an authority created in a county with a population of at least 350,000 persons, in which a hospital district is not located. And so what the petitioner has done here is failed to tell the court about the enactment date, failed to tell the court that the statute relates only to a section on leasing hospital facilities, and failed to tell the court that the statute relates to hospital authorities in counties with a population in excess of 350,000. And there's simply nothing at all in the record, no evidence, which would allow this court to reach a conclusion as a matter of law that the Edinburgh Hospital Authority was subject to section 262.035, even if it existed then, which it didn't. And I think it's really interesting that the legislature passed that subsection D and spelled out that a municipal housing authority is a local unit of government in that particular limited situation of leases. The obvious implication of that is that the legislature was carving out an exception to the general rule that municipal housing hospital authorities are not units of local government.
How about the plain meaning of the word municipality? When you hear the word municipality, you envision a local unit of government that has a mayor, a councilman, a city manager, police functions, parks, garbage collection, and that type of thing. That's what I envision when I hear the word municipality. Do you have any cases that have construed municipality in the sense that municipality can include a library or a hospital?
Well, that's a very interesting point, because the word municipality is not defined in the Tort Claims Act. It's just not defined.
How about the plain meaning of the word?
And that's where the court would go then, to the common usage under the Code Construction Act. And the Code Construction Act also requires that in construing a statute, it's presumed that the intention is that the statute would reach a fair and reasonable result. So what is a fair and reasonable result in this circumstance? The municipality has to include what a municipality does. And in that laundry list that appears in the Tort Claims Act, the governmental functions of a municipality are set out, which includes hospitals. And so it's specifically recognized by the Texas legislature in the laundry list, in the tort claims list, as governmental function of a municipality is the operation of hospitals.
So then you're agreeing that a hospital is a unit of local government?
No, I'm saying that a hospital is a governmental function of a municipality, and thus, so it is part and parcel of the municipality and subject to the caps applicable to municipalities.
A separate municipality?
Pardon me?
Separate and apart from the city?
Well, it's separate in form, but not in substance. And I think the concept that substance controls over form is very well recognized in Texas, and by this court in particular. In fact, I believe this court has been particularly apt in viewing the reality of situations as opposed to the form of situations. And in looking past types of tricks and manipulations that lawyers can come up with in order to reach results which are not based at all on reality. And here, what the defense is suggesting is a distinction between a hospital authority and a municipality, where the municipality created the hospital authority, has the ability to appoint directors, has the ability to dissolve the authority and dispose of the assets. The reality is that there is just no difference. The substance is that there's no difference. And the distinction which is being promoted by the defense in this case is completely and wholly arbitrary. It's not supportable by any type of compelling policy argument, and I believe is proffered for the sole purpose of saving money. The reality is that a municipality like the City of Edinburgh has the authority, and as part of the services it provides to its citizens, to create hospitals, run hospitals, provide for medical care for the citizens of the city. And Chapter 262 is the mechanism that was employed to do that.
Any questions? Thank you, Council.
I share with Council the astonishment of what lawyers can do, as he has just demonstrated. To tell this court that there is no substantive difference between a hospital, a municipal hospital authority, and a city ignores an entire section of Texas legislative enactment entitled Municipal Hospital Authority. That has existed substantially before this case was tried. A hospital authority, as it relates to a city, in that same statute, allows a city to do basically two things. One, appoint the board of directors, and two, to be involved if the hospital authority is to be eliminated, sold, disbanded. That's all. The day-to-day running of that facility is under the authority's board. Has always been. That has never changed. And to suggest that a municipal hospital authority should be treated differently than a county hospital authority, which is likewise entitled to the designation of local unit of government.
When was the authority created?
When was what authority?
The hospital authority.
I don't have that.
Well, was it created after Section 262 was created?
It was I'd have to look at the creation. That's in the record. But section 626 does not, and this is the other point I wanted to make, does not change the way in which a municipal hospital authority had been treated since hospital authorities were permitted. They were initially permitted so that a local unit of government could have a hospital that did not have taxing authority. That was a major motivation for the creation of this particular entity.
Was there anything comparable with section 262.03D prior to June of 1993?
Probably the nearest that I can get to that is the Huckabee case that was totally ignored by the 13th court in this case, that went through an excellent analysis of why it is that a municipal hospital authority should be considered a unit of local government and thus required only to have a $100,000 limit instead of $250,000. That case from Dallas, well reasoned, a case that has not been challenged up until this point, suggested a total analysis of what all a hospital authority board does, totally and separately different and apart from the municipality.
Counsel, let me ask you the same question I asked the opposing counsel about the Tort Claims Act.
Yes.
Why isn't the alleged misuse of this drug, too much of it going on for too long, a use of tangible personal property?
Your Honor, my response to that is that the Tort Claims Act says that use or misuse of tangible personal property that does three things is actionable under the Tort Claims Act: bodily injury, death, or property injury. If there was any injury in this case, I suggest to you it was to the fetus. And as difficult as that is to have to discuss, you have held that injury or death to a fetus is not actionable in this state from the standpoint of damages. To survivors, it is not in the, it's obviously not in the Wrongful Death Act, the Survivors Act, the legislature has put it nowhere. You have held that it is not a false
statement. Mr. Davis, you're not arguing for a blanket exemption from bystander recovery in medical malpractice cases, are you?
In this particular case, no, Your Honor, we're not.
You're merely arguing that the facts of this case don't meet the Freeman standard?
And we have discussed that in our brief, the facts of this case and our judgment do not, at least on points 1 and 2, come within the Freeman requirements.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
That concludes the argument in the first test. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.